Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Oklahoma Center of Community and Justice's 30th Annual Trilogue Interfaith Dialogue Series kicks off this Sunday with a look at the future of interfaith dialogue and how digital connectivity is affecting it, as well as religion and belief itself. The first of these three sessions takes place Sunday at 2 o'clock at the Charles Schusterman Jewish Community Center. This year's theme is Are You Godwired? High Tech Plus High Touch, the Future of Interfaith Dialogue. The first session will look at the data stream of faith. Experts will provide trends, data, and demography on the religious life in contemporary America from the margins to the mainstream. The speakers will include Alicia Brooks from the Southern Poverty Law Center, as well as my guest today, Dr. Charles Kimball, a presidential professor and director of religious studies at the University of Oklahoma in Norman. Dr. Kimball is a noted author and speaker on the intersection of religion and politics in the United States, Jewish, Christian, and Muslim relations, as well as Islam and the Middle East. He's the author of several books, including When Religion Becomes Evil, which was critically acclaimed, and his most recent book, published last year, is titled When Religion Becomes Lethal. His writings have also appeared in the Los Angeles Times, the Christian Science Monitor, and the Boston Globe. Again, he'll be a featured speaker this Sunday at 2 o'clock in the Trilogue Interfaith Dialogue, and the program is free and open to the public. Dr. Charles Kimball, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. Nice to be with you.
This weekend at Trilogue, you'll be setting the stage for the series, which focuses on where we are as far as it comes to interfaith dialogue in this day and age. You'll be looking at a lot of the trends of contemporary religious life. And when I hear about trends in contemporary religious life in America, everything I'm hearing is about this Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life poll that just came out that showed a 5% rise over the past 5 years in the religiously unaffiliated. And I think a lot of, especially mainstream American Protestant churches, are really concerned about this. How important is this new data coming out?
I think it's very significant. And the 5% is actually a little misleading because Pew does very extensive studies. This is a very detailed, very sophisticated analysis. They do this about every 5 years. They and some other Gallup and some other institutions produce other kinds of data periodically, but this kind of comprehensive study is done about every 5 years. And what the Pew study showed this last just in the last couple of months is that the number of people, the so-called nones, N-O-N-E-S, none of the above is the idea, who don't check off that they are affiliated formally with a religious tradition like Christianity or Islam or Judaism, has risen from 15% of the overall American population back in 2007 to 20%. So it's a 5% increase, but it's a 33% jump in the number. So it's now 1 in 5 Americans check off none of the above. And there's a very clear trend and pattern by generation. If you go back to the World War II generation, people now who are in their really 80s and above, it was 1 in 20 people who would check that off. And now it's 1 in 5. So, and you can, as you move down through the different age groups, you see that number growing. There's a lot less formal identification. Now, one thing that's important to underscore, I think, is that 80% of the population is checking off some affiliation. Not 20% is not, but 80% is. And when you compare to France or Great Britain, where the number of people who affiliate with a religious tradition formally is in the teens. So by contrast, the United States is still a very religiously oriented, self sort of identified religious community. But this number of unaffiliated, and it's interesting, it's not just a growth in atheism and agnosticism. People who categorize themselves in that way, that those numbers have grown some. But the study also showed that something like 68% of the people who say none of the above believe in God or some kind of higher power. Over half of them say they pray regularly. So there's some dimension of spirituality or connection to another dimension of life, but they're not finding that matched up very well, at least a growing number, particularly in the 18 to 25-year-old age group, not finding it very helpfully connected to a particular religious tradition like being a Catholic or a Presbyterian or a Lutheran or whatever.
And the losses in numbers comes completely just about from Christianity, mostly from Protestant Christianity.
Yeah.
And mostly, again, if you separate that out, in mainline Protestant faiths. But evangelicals are losing too.
Yeah, I was going to say the evangelical churches, which have enjoyed a very steady rise and were kind of a growth industry for a while, have certainly tapered off and You don't see those same kind of numbers, but the bigger drops are found in the so-called mainline churches, the Methodists, Lutherans, Presbyterians, Episcopalians, those traditional sort of denominations that have been the sort of backbone of America. Those Protestant denominations now constitute a little less than 50% of the population, and that's the first time ever, I think, that Protestant Christians have been less than half the population.
And by contrast, other religions is actually gaining slightly. It's still, we have to always remember that we are a predominantly Christian nation as far as the makeup of the country, but other religions increased just slightly, like 4 to maybe 6%, I think, if I remember my numbers correctly.
Yeah, and some of that is immigration. Yeah. Some of that is via conversion. And this has certainly been a trend, not huge numbers, but we've certainly seen since the 60s, especially when there was a tremendous emphasis on the Eastern religious traditions, a lot more people who, for the first time, you know, were discovering different aspects of the Hindu tradition or the Buddhist tradition in different forms, rebirth of Native American spirituality and so forth. There are different things that account for what has interested people, and the access, obviously, the kind of access now that's possible via the Internet. If you want to read Buddhist scriptures, you're 2 clicks away, where that wasn't possible, you know, decades ago. So there's more possibility for people to explore some other kinds of spirituality or options than would have been the case previously. The rise of the number of people who identify themselves as none of the above, that's a fairly dramatic, you know, growth. But the decline in mainline Protestant Christianity has been happening over a period of time. So some of what you see, and a lot of even mainline churches now, are alternative worship services. They might have an early service or even 2 services at 11 o'clock, say, on Sunday morning. One is the sort of traditional service, but another one might have a band and very informal attire and so forth. Some of the things that have happened in some of the evangelical megachurches have been copied by others trying to attract a younger audience and, you know, get more consistent with the times, as it were. And that's been effective in some places. It's not very attractive to others. So you see variations on that kind of theme. But, you know, one of the problems, too, these older churches, many of them are having and have had for some years major issues and challenges just with the physical structures of the buildings. As their congregants have aged, you know, they have to put in elevators. These are churches that were built without, you know, handicap access or the ability to get from floor 1 to floor 3, you know, suddenly you've got to replace a roof and put in, you know, an elevator or some other things that cost a lot of money. And you have a smaller congregation and less resources. So there are a lot of factors that start working against. And that's one reason why you saw the growth of many of the mega churches out in the suburbs where they could, you know, take new land and have a big campus and create effectively a kind of minor town or city where they had everything going from basketball leagues to shopping areas to bridge clubs to whatever that were very attractive to people that you couldn't offer in a very fixed space where the roof was falling down.
It's interesting when you look into that Pew study, the idea of the social connections is one which doesn't have resonance with the non-religiously affiliated. And when you ask them why they don't have a religious affiliation, a lot of times they associate church with power and money and they're too involved with politics. And so often when churches try to address some of these issues, they do the things that you're talking about, which is, you know, to make it more socially oriented, to, you know, have different styles of worship to appeal to different types of people. But they don't ever get at those central questions, which seem to be predominant in most of the survey results.
Yeah, that'll be very interesting to watch because obviously people in political parties looking at trends pay attention to these sort of things a lot. Part of what the Pew study revealed was that a very large and growing number of the younger part of the population is perceiving organized religion in terms of highly partisan politics, in terms of great rigidity, do's and don'ts. This is, you know, all the things you're supposed to do and not do, whether it's conservative Christianity or Sharia law, perceptions of Sharia law in Islam or whatever it may be, and the highly partisan political environment. I mean, you'll see this, for example, just in this week with the apparent reversal of position by the Boy Scouts of America to accept, you know, gay boys and men into the ranks of the Boy Scouts and even Scout leaders. Well, immediately, you know, leaders of the Southern Baptist Convention took to the airwaves and said, well, this is just not acceptable. So it's that kind of identification with organized religion and strong social issues and political stances and so forth that have turned some people off as well.
I want to ask you a question about the polarization of discourse, because certainly the political discourse is increasing, and I think the perception is that religious discourse is also becoming increasingly polarized. Do you think that's a reflection of the political situation, or maybe vice versa?
In my experience, this is a bit anecdotal, I suppose, but I travel and lecture all over the country and have been for a number of years. And certainly, let's just take in the last decade plus since the events of 9/11, what I've seen are two different trends. There's a tremendous effort on the part of many churches and many Jewish congregations as well to reach out, to connect with Muslim neighbors, to build on the history of Jewish-Christian relations, which have been very good in the last 50 years or so, and have education programs, dialogue programs, events where you engage one another, work on projects together. And even some very conservative churches have done this. At the same time, there have been people on the extreme among each of these communities, but especially, I would say, among Christians and some Muslims, who have gone the other direction and really dug in their heels and have been very, very belligerent in their attitude towards people who don't agree with them. And so you've seen both happen. You've seen a sharpening, a sort of hostile rhetoric. Muslims are evil and they're trying to take over the world and we have to stop it. But at the same time, you've seen a very large number of people saying, look, we share a small planet. We have to learn to live together. We look around our own neighborhood and see, yes, Christians are in the majority, but Islam is now or soon will be the second largest religious community in the United States. You know, when I get a prescription filled at the local drugstore and the guy's name is Muhammad, who's fulfilling my subscription, that might tell me something. Mm-hmm. There our neighbors are Muslims and Hindus and Buddhists and Jews, and, you know, you go to a PTA meeting and you realize we're not in Norman Rockwell's America anymore. And so there's a lot of awareness on the part of a lot of people, even people who have very strong religious beliefs, that as we do in the business world, as we do in environmental issues and health issues, we better find ways to talk to each other and to live together peaceably. And so there's a lot of good things that are going on to bridge some of those gaps, at least to live together cooperatively, even if there's ideological divides.
My guest today is Dr. Charles Kimball, a presidential professor and director of religious studies at the University of Oklahoma. He's the author of two very highly regarded books among his many books, and that's the most recent, When Religion Becomes Lethal, and his previous book, When Religion Becomes Evil. He'll be addressing the 30th Annual Trialogue Interfaith series, and this year they're going to be examining the data streams of faith, which is going to look at how we're using computers and technology in religion today, but also the future of interfaith dialogue. And I'd like to talk about that if we can, because, you know, there seems like to me there was a time when, you know, interfaith dialogue didn't happen, and then there was this sort of golden era for about 20 or 30 years, especially around civil rights and around religious plurality rights, where interfaith dialogue was very important. And while since 9/11, there's also been some very important interfaith dialogue things going on and activities, to me it seems like it's waned a little bit over the last few years. And you increasingly see a lot of denominations and maybe even religions that have participated in interfaith that are sort of shying away. And I'm not sure exactly why. Why would you say that is?
Well, I'm not entirely sure that's the case. I think that there may be some truth to that, but I don't know that I've seen any kind of study that would reflect that in a, you know, sort of systematic way. I think part of the impression comes from, you know, what we're aware of, what we see. And one of the challenges of interfaith dialogue and cooperation has been, you know, how newsworthy is it? You know, when very thoughtful leaders in congregations in Tulsa or anywhere else get together to engage issues of concern in the community, crime or, you know, rehabilitation of people from jail and prisons and that sort of thing, well, that doesn't produce news. Mm. But, you know, one person putting a bomb in a mosque or, you know, defacing a Jewish cemetery or something like that, well, we, you know, the media can't get there fast enough to cover that. And so we tend to get a lot of information, and certainly coming out of the Middle East where there's a great deal of turmoil, the media, especially television media, tends to gravitate towards what's most dramatic and most sensational. And we don't see a lot of the other things that are going on at the local level where people are actually getting along and cooperating and working on things. So I think some of it is becoming more routine. And so maybe it's some of the novelty And a lot has changed rather dramatically. I mean, I grew up in Tulsa, and I was born and raised there. And I remember pretty distinctly as a child in the 50s, I was born in 1950, that people routinely used to talk about Catholics and Christians as though these were two different categories.
That's right.
And so, you know, the first phase of interfaith dialogue for some people was just Catholics talking to Protestants. And certainly we have had a lot of movement in the area of Jewish-Christian understanding that's been quite different than what most of Christian history has been, which has been rather bleak from the Jewish side, to put it mildly. As one of my rabbi friends once put it, 2,000 years of Christian love is almost more than we Jews can bear. and you know, if you study the history of Christian-Jewish relations, you get the point. It's a very painful history, and Christians have much to be ashamed of in terms of how Jews have been treated under dominant Christian rule. We've seen a lot of movement in the area of Christian Muslim and Jewish Christian Muslim dialogue, and the kind of trilogue effort that goes on in Tulsa is a great example of that. So maybe part of it is the novelty, the newness of that has worn off a little bit, and some of it is not as newsworthy. But the very fact that this program has been going for 30 years and is happening this year again is an indication that things are going on, but they are made more difficult too by fear and frustration when people see things continually on the news and get, you know, various preachers and radio commentators blasting away. Then there's more education to be done just on, you know, what Islam is and what are the opportunities for dialogue when a different kind of image is being presented all the time.
I guess my point was, you know, as overt discrimination has subsided, mm-hmm. and sort of, you know, the whispered slurs and the like, that is no longer tolerated. Our rhetoric on certain issues in interfaith relationships, there's a lot of things that used to be said that you just can't be said anymore.
That's helpful. I
think it's helpful, but it also maybe is lessened the urgency maybe for interfaith dialogue in a lot of times.
It makes many in the majority community feel less urgent, but if
yes.
you're a Muslim in Oklahoma, it was
Absolutely.
Only a couple of years ago that
yes.
70% of the people voted to ban Sharia law. And I've talked to over 100 people about this sort of casually, just to sort of test the waters, many of them clergy, and I've yet to find anybody, aside from Muslim friends, who could even tell me what Sharia law was. And so many of them were quite convinced it's coming to get us, but we're going to stop it right here in Oklahoma first, but couldn't tell me what it was or why it was so dangerous. So if you're on the Muslim side, the issues haven't subsided a whole lot when you have that kind of fear and stereotypical responses. And I don't know a Muslim in Oklahoma. I know many, many, but I don't know a single Muslim who has any desire to see Sharia law implemented in the United States or in Oklahoma. It's more a code of personal conduct and kind of religious guidance on what is appropriate, you know, they feel. And it varies a lot. It's not just one thing. Islamic law is a lot of things. It's always been a work in progress. So the sort of images are just incorrect. So I would just, I guess, underscore that the urgency may not feel the same if the majority community feels like we're more politically correct than we used to be
mm-hmm.
about certain things.
That's true.
But, you know, when you feel it from the other side and see that kind of stereotypical language, you know, it's reason for concern.
We're getting into the subject of your most recent book, When Religion Becomes Lethal, which is, you've been looking at these issues for a number of years, and I think the short version is when politics and religion merge. I mean, religion and politics, when they get together, there's a tendency for inflamed rhetoric and bad action afterwards.
Yeah, it's what I'm doing in this new book is really looking at the explosive mix of religion and politics in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, both historically, but also through contemporary examples, and then, you know, looking to the future, what kinds of things can we do? And part of what I'm arguing is that religion and politics are always linked in some ways, that you can't totally de-link them, even though there are efforts to judiciously sort of walk that, but you're dealing with human beings, and you're dealing with, you know, the dominant majority of people throughout history and even today perceive themselves to be religious, and that you can't de-link that from real life and political life and so forth. But how do you structure that? What do you do with that? And part of what I outline in detail in the book is go back and say, well, what does the Bible really say? What does the Quran really say? We hear people making claims all over the place about what God wants in terms of a religious state, whether a Christian nation or a Jewish state in Israel or you know, an Islamic state. And we're going to see many experiments with that in coming years and decades, I think, the Islamic State side. But what is the real basis for these claims? And so I try to look at that, and part of what I demonstrate, I think, is that there is no template in any of these traditions, including Islam, for exactly how you do this. It's always a work in progress. It always adapts to the time and place and circumstances. And so what I try to do is show how varied that is, and that that's normal, and that part of what has made these religious traditions actually succeed over time is that they're much more flexible and pliable than most people perceive. And so the challenge really goes back to those who think they have the answer to demonstrate, you know, why it is that their particular vision of what God wants for them and everybody else is the one that this time is going to work, and set forth some options for how we can approach the future and have more a better chance at a more healthy and hopeful future in the midst of very strong claims, sometimes from people who are heavily armed and will not accept alternative views. That's a real challenge in today's world.
When you actually go back and look at what God's will is, it's changed over time, depending on whether you're looking at the Hebrew Bible, the Christian Bible, or the Quran.
Well, precisely. If you're looking for the model, say, in the Hebrew Bible, it's a divine monarchy. That becomes the model of religion and the state. But, you know, that changes over time, and certainly when Israel is reestablished in the 20th century, you'd be hard-pressed to find anybody who says, well, wait a minute, here's what the Bible tells us we should do. No, these were largely socialist-leaning people out of Eastern Europe who were shaping a contemporary democracy with a very different vision. They drew upon Jewish sources, to be sure, but were not looking to recreate the Davidic kingdom with David and Solomon on the throne. Similarly, with Christianity, you know, much of church history, of course, has been a very close connection between religion and politics, even though the first thing that one of the chapter titles I have is Render Unto Caesar. You know, most people, if you ask them, most Christians, say, well, what does the Bible, New Testament say? They'll say, oh, well, Jesus said, render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar, and unto God the things that are God's. So that means separate them. Well, if you look at church history, that clearly is not the way most Christians have understood the relationship historically from the Holy Roman Empire. And even when you come down to the Protestant tradition, I have a section on this tremendous shift away from what was going on within the Catholic Church and the perceived problems and malfunctions and so forth. Look at John Calvin's Geneva, anything but a separation of church and state. I mean, there were all kinds of religious infractions for which you could be put to death in Calvin's Geneva. And even in the United States, there were multiple experiments before the United States came into the, you know, form of the Revolution and the Constitution as we have it. You know, this was, the colonies were here for 150 years with very different approaches to religion and the state, and Massachusetts Bay Colony and Virginia and William Penn's Quaker Pennsylvania. Very different models were being experimented with before the formula was achieved, really, by the leadership of Jefferson, Madison, and others, which I think was brilliant, actually, and I try to articulate that, very much matched the time and the circumstances post-Enlightenment, and has held up extraordinarily well, and I think actually provides a kind of framework that the rest of the world needs desperately to embrace and modify appropriately for how do we live together with our religious commitments and religious differences.
My guest today is Dr. Charles Kimball, Presidential Professor and Director of Religious Studies at the University of Oklahoma. His most recent book is When Religion Becomes Lethal, and that follows on When Religion Becomes Evil, published several years ago. He'll be addressing the 30th Annual Interfaith Trilogue Series, examining the data streams of faith, and that's the first program. The next two programs will look at high-touch dialogue for today, looking at how people can come together face-to-face and talk honestly about similarities and differences. And then look at how high-tech communication has affected global dialogue. And that's over the next three Sundays. It begins this Sunday at 2 o'clock at the Charles Schusterman Jewish Community Center. And you're going to be talking about some of the things we talked about, but you'll also be just looking at the relationship between Christians and Muslims as well.
Right. And several of the things that we have talked about briefly will be part of what I'll explore a little bit more is why, in particular, the Christian-Muslim dialogue and engagement has been so difficult historically. One component of that that I think you have to take very seriously is that once Christianity grew beyond its humble Jewish origins and began to develop and become a world religion, if you think about it, nothing has really ever threatened the existence of Christianity except Islam. No other religious tradition ever really posed a serious threat. I mean, Scandinavian mythology wasn't going to overwhelm Christianity, and Native American religions weren't, and so forth. Judaism was there, but wasn't going to topple Christianity. But Islam arises as this extraordinarily powerful military, religious, civilizational system that comes to dominate much of the world for many centuries, a brilliant civilizational system. And that really threatened Christendom in a way that nothing else ever had. And of course, you had crusades and inquisitions and things over the centuries that heightened that. And so there is this kind of built-in dynamic related to Islam that you don't find, say, with the Hindu tradition or Buddhist tradition historically, that I think creates more of an obstacle. It's a religion that in many ways, it certainly builds upon Judeo-Christian heritage. Islam understands itself as the continuation of the same religion. Obviously, that's not how Jews and Christians have tended to understand Islam historically, but that's how Muslims understand themselves, as the same revelation that God gave to Moses and to Jesus, to many prophets, has given also to, one last time, to the prophet Muhammad. And so there is this self-understanding and connection with sacred space and sacred people and sacred stories that these three traditions that all trace themselves to Abraham share, that is very different than what you find, say, with Christian Buddhist relations or Christian relations with the Chinese tradition, something like that. And Islam and Christianity are the two largest religions. They're both missionary religions. They constitute well over 40% of the world's population. And so there is a dynamic that has made that particular relationship more challenging, and that still exists very much today, I think.
When you look at Judeo-Christian relationships, it took us two millennia to come to accommodation. Is time a big part of that conflict?
Yeah, I think that is a factor. And you know, if you talk to a number of American Jews, you'll quickly get the sense that they're not quite as sanguine about Jewish-Christian relations, maybe, as many Christians are.
This is true.
That there's not quite as much reason for trust yet, because there's still, a lot of anti-Semitism out there, a lot of anti-Jewish bias. I mean, certainly things have improved dramatically in the last 50 or 60 years, but there's still a long way to go, and we've made some headway, I would say, but there's still a great deal of work to be done in terms of education, cooperation, learning how to engage the other communities, recognizing that there are people within all of these communities, and this is part of what I deal with, of course, in my books, who really are extremists, who really are violent, who really are dangerous. We can't simply act like those people don't exist. But we do have to understand, I think, that the number of violent extremists operating under the banner of Islam or perceiving themselves as operating with an Islamic mandate is a very tiny minority on the fringe. It's a dangerous minority, but it is a tiny minority, and the vast majority of Muslims are people just like everybody else we know. I mean, they're raising their children, they're trying to get them off to school, fix a flat tire. I mean, they're living normal lives, not plotting anything or trying to blow up anything or take over the world. How do we break through those sort of stereotypical images and engage the vast majority of people who are normal human beings living normal lives and who want to engage with their neighbors? That's part of the challenge, I think, especially when it comes to Islam, where there's a lot of education still to be done.
Dr. Kimball, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Rich. Appreciate it.
Dr. Charles Kimball is the Presidential Professor and Director of Religious Studies at the University of Oklahoma in Norman, and the author of When Religion Becomes Lethal. He'll be one of the featured speakers at the first session of this year's Oklahoma Center for Community and Justice's Interfaith Trilogue Series, which takes place this Sunday at 2 o'clock at the Charles Schusterman Jewish Community Center at 2021 East 71st Street. The programs are free and open to the public. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.